2010-5012, Beer against the United States, and for the benefit of the parties, we will not hold you tightly to the time limitations. So let's proceed. Mr. Landau.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Chris Landau, and I'm here today on behalf of the plaintiffs. The Supreme Court remanded this case for this Court to consider, in the first instance, the government's preclusion argument. According to the government, my clients can't bring this case because they were absent members in another case, Williams, of which they received no notice and had no opportunity to opt out. That argument fails.
The government says that they did have actual notice. Is that sufficient?
Your Honor, that is completely speculative. In the first place, there's no record.
Let's assume that they did actually receive notice of it, that they knew about the case. Is that sufficient?
Two points, Your Honor. It depends the notice of what. The government just says they had notice of Williams. That's not the constitutionally adequate notice in the first place, because the notice that is constitutionally required is notice that the case was certified as a non-opt-out class action. Just knowing in the lunchroom that there was a case filed called Williams is not enough. And again, the important point is that's just speculative. But even assuming, Your Honor, that they had actual notice, so even that, to answer your question specifically, it's not enough, because opt-out is also a minimum, irreducible minimum of due process.
Let's suppose it is. Let's suppose all that's required is notice. I'm really wondering whether actual notice is sufficient. For example, if somebody commences an action, A against B, and B knows about the action, that's not sufficient. You've got to bring the person into court with the service of process. Why isn't formal notice from the court required and actual notice insufficient?
I agree, Your Honor. And certainly, again, even there isn't even actual notice or certainly no record, but I think Your Honor's point is a good one, and that's why we have systems in our law. The rules set forth a certain kind of notice. It's not just kind of like you should, if you see something in the newspaper that you suddenly, and so you may actually hear that, gee, there's a class action, and that you suddenly have an obligation to go in and do something. I think the most important point here is an absent class member doesn't have any affirmative obligation to do anything. As the court said in Schutz, unlike a defendant in a normal civil suit, an absent class action plaintiff is not required to do anything. He may sit back and allow the litigation to run its course, content in knowing that there are safeguards provided for his protection. The court and the litigants, the way the class action mechanism is set up is that the court has an obligation to look out for the interests of the absent class member. The absent class member doesn't have an obligation to affirmatively go into court.
Can I ask you about the Tycor case? If you can walk me through what you understand the court to have done in that case, because it seems to me it's a little odd, and I understand your argument is that even passing Tycor in the res judicata point, you have a fallback onto the due process. But as to the res judicata point, it seems peculiar, if my reading of Tycor is correct, for the court to have said that there's an open question as to whether Rule 23 binds a non-participant, but that question was not open in that case because the Rule 23 issue was resolved in a case in which these parties did not participate.
I agree with you, Your Honor. I think one thing...
It sounds quirky to put that way. Is there an explanation for the court's decision that, in your view, either makes more sense or is more consistent with the position that your clients are taking in this case?
Your Honor, I think it's important to
setting aside due process for the moment.
Sure. I think it's important to keep in mind, first and foremost, that Tycor was a decision dismissing a writ as improvidently granted.
Of course.
So I think, you know, this particular issue was not briefed in Tycor, that Tycor was briefed up as the ultimate due process challenge, and the court said, gee, we don't really want to be getting the due process issue, and it looks like there's a big Rule 23 issue, so let's just get, this is just not a good vehicle. But I agree with you that there is an anomaly, and that really is the same anomaly that exists for due process too, of saying that a person should be bound in any way by something that happened in a different case. It's very strange to think that even with respect to the class part of Tycor. Why absent class members?
Well, it's not just that the ultimate decision is that they are bound or aren't bound, but that they're foreclosed from litigating that under the rule because that question was already decided, albeit in a proceeding in which they were not a party.
And that seems kind of fundamentally antithetical to our system of justice.
Well, is there an explanation that you've discerned for that makes more sense for Tycor?
Your Honor, again, there isn't really. I haven't been able to come up with anything better. I think that Tycor is the same anomaly. But again, our point is, even accepting that Tycor actually stands for that proposition that you can be bound by anything in a case to which you were a complete stranger, I mean, Tycor might make more sense if the class there had actually been a regular B3 class action where the absent class members did receive notice and opportunity to opt out.
Sure, the problem would go away.
The problem would go away.
B2,
but I agree with you, it seems anomalous. But at the end of the day, the point is, whatever Tycor means, it certainly doesn't mean, and the government acknowledges this in their reply brief, that we don't have our full due process rights to challenge the preclusive effect. And as a practical matter, I think that since the rules were written to preserve due process, the analysis essentially tracks each other. I'm not sure that there is a huge gap there between what the rules provide and what due process requires.
But you would, if that's true, then you would not contest the applicability of a B2 class action to a pure equitable action, setting aside the incidental, whether or not incidental monetary relief is equitable or not, but just a pure injunctive or declaratory.
Assuming that it satisfies all the other criteria, Rule 23A, and it's a legitimate class action otherwise, yes.
But I mean, nonetheless, no, and that is okay, and monetary relief is not okay in a due process sense. Why?
Well, Your Honor, I think that really, it goes back to this. Due process 101, before you can be deprived of any kind of property right, you are entitled to notice and opportunity.
I think what Judge Bryson is asking you, if I understand correctly, is that, is it clear that a party to a B2 class action who didn't have notice and opportunity to be heard would be bound by the result as to injunctive relief?
Yeah.
Is that established by the Supreme Court cases? I'm not sure it is.
I see. So you're saying, well, if it is a B2 case, there may be circumstances, even in B1 or B2 actions, where notice is required, and the rules 23C is what provides for notice in class actions. And for instance, in B1 limited fund cases, and the Ortiz case gets into this, there are circumstances in which you may have a limited fund for money, and notice is required in those particular cases, even though as a general matter, notice is not required in B1 and B2
well, maybe
cases.
For all we know, and I don't see that the Supreme Court has decided this, that there's some language about it. It may be that in B2 class actions generally, you can't bind an absent class member who didn't receive notice at all. The due process in order to bind the absent class member in a B2 class action requires notice.
It's certainly, again, our fundamental.
Are you conceding that the Supreme Court has said it's okay not to give notice and to bind people in B2
no,
class?
No, not, certainly not categorically, Your Honor. Again.
In any case?
The rule. I don't know that we're saying that B2 is unconstitutional on its face because the rule, again, says the court may give notice.
Yeah, it's not a question of whether B2 is unconstitutional. It's a question of whether in a subsequent action, due process forbids you to bind an absent class member in a B2 injunctive action. I don't know what, I'm not sure what the answer is.
Well, and I agree with your, the instinct underlying your point, which is it's very problematic in our system to say that somebody who is a stranger to a case and wants to file a lawsuit, somebody says, guess what, there's this other case over here of which you never heard that binds you. Guess what? You can't do it. Now, the court has at least suggested, or the lower courts have suggested, that that's okay when you're talking about declaratory or injunctive relief. And so the question isn't why money...
At least so you have adequate representation.
Correct, or all the other things are met. But the question really isn't why is money different. The question is, those are the carve-outs, declaratory injunctive relief, where the idea is that that relief is indivisible, and so you necessarily, the idea is that you will, you're kind of a free rider. You will get the relief whether you want to or not. And so the court...
Or you will be denied the relief...
Or you will be
notwithstanding that you had a good argument for why you should be getting it.
Right, but again,
you won't be able,
whatever the rule is, purely in
law injunctions,
whatever,
you will not be able to come back.
That's true, and I mean that is certainly problematic in and of itself. But the point here is, as the court I think underscored in Walmart, when you have money involved, these concerns are present in spades. And then the question really becomes, in the Williams case, to which the government is trying to give preclusive effect here, was the only question the court left open in Walmart was, could you certify a class that includes some claims for monetary relief and without giving notice and opt-out rights? And the court said, well, we don't decide that question. That raises a very serious constitutional problem if there's any monetary component. But certainly in this case, we don't have to decide that entire question because the only circumstance in which that might be possible, might, is where the monetary relief is incidental. And it defined incidental as being individualized and flowing directly from injunctive or declaratory relief. The government focuses only on the individualized part of that and says the whole world is divided into individualized versus non-individualized claims. That is just not the way Walmart defined it. Individualized is necessary but not sufficient to be incidental. And then the question really goes, it can't possibly be that Williams involved incidental monetary claims because it was a Tucker Act case. And under the Tucker Act, as your honors know, because this court probably sees more Tucker Act cases, well, sees all the Tucker Act cases by definition, the Tucker Act is limited, jurisdictionally, the waiver of sovereign immunity is limited to claims for money damages. So Williams can't possibly have been a case primarily for declaratory or injunctive relief. Williams was a case about money, and the government conceded that in its brief in this court.
Floating through this case and others is this notion that back pay is an equitable remedy. We see it in various places. Where does that notion come from, if you know?
Your Honor, I think that is a... That has been the subject of a lot of debate, and if you look at Bowen and Knutson, the two Supreme Court cases that discuss this issue, Justice Stevens has the majority in Bowen saying that it's back equitable. Justice Scalia is in dissent. Justice Scalia gets the majority in Knutson basically saying that money is virtually always legal in nature. But again, I think I guess my point there is just to say that distinction is kind of murky when back pay.
You said it doesn't matter. B2 talks about injunctions.
My windup was too long, Your Honor. It doesn't matter, is the point. And the question is it monetary relief? So the legal equitable issue of back pay, and the Supreme Court made this quite clear in Walmart, it doesn't matter because the question is, when you're talking about money, that you whatever might allow courts to dispense with notice and opt-out rights in cases that are declaratory or injunctive, when you're talking about money relief, those considerations aren't there. Whether the money is treated as equitable or not equitable misses the point. And I think that's one of the primary lessons of Walmart. Mm-hmm. And so you don't have to get into that point. And so again, the question is, however you look at back pay, the point remains, it is seeking monetary relief, and therefore notice and opt-out rights are constitutionally required, as well as required by the rule. If the government were correct in their view of the world that all you need to look at is the claim individualized or not, you could have non-individualized claims purely for money without any relationship to a declaratory or injunctive claim. and that would be perfectly fine to certify on a non-opt-out basis and could be given preclusive effect without any kind of problem. But that's not the line that the Supreme Court has ever drawn.
Can I lead you to another point?
Sure.
Are the issues in this case the same as they are in Williams? And let me tell you what my concern is about that. That what Williams did not involve the 2001 statute, which was enacted after our decision. It involved the validity of earlier statutes, 95 and so on. This case involves the 2001 statute. Does that have any bearing on whether the issue in the two cases is the same, and does that bear on whether there would be issue preclusion if the due process requirements were satisfied?
Your Honor, I don't think that the 2001 statute changes my client's constitutional arguments, because all my clients were on the bench before 2001. So whatever the 2001 statute did, it couldn't have changed whatever expectations that they had or whatever rights they had going to the merits of their claims. The 2001 statute couldn't have reduced their rights constitutionally.
That's somewhat of a different issue, and it is important with respect to the 2007 COLA, which isn't governed by the earlier statute.
Right, and our claim is only for the 2007, because we brought this case in 2009, and you can go back 6 years under the statute of limitations. But the question is, does the 2001 statute change the analysis or the legal issue? Because this is issue preclusion, you're right. And Judge Newman, in her dissent from the initial hearing on bond petition as this case was working its way up the first time, suggested that the Supreme Court's decision in Hatter and the 2001 statute did make a difference in the issue. I think with respect, our claims, though, if Williams is correct, it's not obvious how the 2001 statute changes the basic analysis of Williams, or the issue that Williams decided, the legal issue that...
The government seems to suggest that there might be a difference between the 2001 statute and the earlier statute.
Well, if there is...
At least in this CERTA. Right?
Certainly, we don't want to argue that... I mean, we don't believe there's issue preclusion at all. So, you know, to the extent there is daylight there and it's not the same issue, that's great by us. I'm not going to stand here today and I'm not going to argue against it, certainly. But again, we think that even if you don't go there and say that the issue is not the same, this is kind of due process 101, that you can't tell people, guess what? You want to bring a lawsuit about your pay. It's hard to imagine a more classic or quintessentially monetary judgment than your pay. And again, even however you characterize pay, equitable, legal, it's still your pay. And
it doesn't make it. I mean, perhaps it doesn't matter, but it doesn't necessarily make it legal, oddly enough.
Well, fair enough,
whole line of civil rights cases that have probably, because of the original 64 Act, didn't have a jury trial, right, and the courts had to deal with the problem of where is the Seventh Amendment coming in here, and they said no Seventh Amendment problem because this is equitable,
right,
which
right.
is an odd concept, but
right.
That's the way they did it.
Right.
I wonder how broadly that principle
right.
applies, and again, it may matter.
Yeah,
but,
I think
but
it really if, doesn't.
Cause if it does, then perhaps that notion that back pay is equitable in nature is confined to the Civil Rights Act.
It doesn't matter, and again, let's not lose sight of the fact that Williams was a Tucker Act case. So the government has a quandary here. Either there was no jurisdiction under Williams in the first, it was a little Tucker Act case. Either there was no jurisdiction in Williams in the first place because it was primarily seeking equitable or declaratory relief, not injunctive or declaratory relief. That's the line that is drawn.
Right.
Or the money predominated and therefore can't be given preclusive effect. They can't have it both ways. And it's kind of curious when you see the government in Williams acquiescing in the certification of a non-opt-out class on the basis under B2 that it's that it's seeking declaratory injunctive relief, and then coming to this court and saying, well, Your Honors, you know, we have a, we're noting a point about Tucker Act jurisdiction. You can't have the claim, again, what the government said is the claim in Williams is essentially one for money damages, which is true here. We quoted this in our reply brief, the words from the government's brief, and of course it has to be that way, because there couldn't have been jurisdiction in Williams. The waiver of sovereign immunity is limited to money. So again, there may be cases where it's hard to decide, you know, A, this court doesn't have to decide the answer to this constitutional question the Supreme Court left open in Walmart, whether there's ever a time when claims for monetary monetary relief may not require notice and opt-out rights, because the only door it left open was whether incidental. And we know, because of the Tucker Act jurisdiction in Williams, that whatever incidental means monetary damages, it couldn't possibly have been incidental in a Tucker Act case.
I have one other question. You mentioned the statute of limitations a moment ago. Do you agree that the statute of limitations bars challenges to the earlier statutes from 95 to 99?
Your Honor, I think it bars us from challenging them directly and saying we want to recover money going back to 1995. I think where what we asked for in our complaint was to say we can go back 6 years, but then what we believe is that the base salary that we get going back 6 years should reflect those earlier...
Statute of limitations doesn't bar that.
Doesn't bar that. Yes, Your Honor. I mean, that's a remedial question we can get to down the road. But that's our theory, Your Honor, yes.
Very well. We'll reserve your rebuttal time and your permission.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Simpson.
May it please the Court. From the outset, I'd like to address the point made by Mr. Landau that the Williams case was entirely a Tucker Act suit, and therefore there's some type of tension between the arguments we're making now and the statements made in the government's brief in that case. Back then, Williams was not solely a Little Tucker Act suit. It was a suit grounded on both the Little Tucker Act and the federal question jurisdiction under Section 1331. And for that reason...
Well, the complaint recites the Little Tucker Act alone, right?
That's correct. The original complaint, it was amended during that case to add 1331 as a jurisdictional basis.
What is the cause of action other than Little Tucker Act? I mean, where do you have the authority for the court to come in and grant relief that wouldn't be authorized by the Little Tucker Act?
Well, the Williams plaintiffs argued, and this court noted in its decision, that the jurisdiction on that aspect of the case came from the compensation clause itself, which this court in Hatter held was a money mandating provision. Mm-hmm. And so that substantive right combined.
Again, that's money, though. I mean, that it's money mandating, and that means it's monetary.
Mm-hmm. The district court, being a court of general jurisdiction, would have the authority to issue declaratory judgments or declarations of the party's rights in the context of that suit under 1331, and that, in fact, is what the court did.
Well, you know, even the Court of Federal Claims in a back pay suit will, in a sense, order, declare the party's rights, because in order to enter a judgment in favor of plaintiffs, for example, the court has to say, I think the government is wrong in its theory that they shouldn't have been paid according to the plaintiff's theory. So the court says that, paragraph one, paragraph two, therefore I order the government to pay back pay. But it's a declaration, I suppose, of sorts, but it isn't regarded as a form of injunctive and declaratory relief in the sense that we usually use that. And what it all goes to is the monetary award. Isn't that really the same thing that happened here?
Not in the Williams. Not in the Williams.
No, that's what I mean.
You're focusing on the future rule.
Correct.
That's being granted. Not the order to make the back pay payment, but the order that in the future that the compensation be computed in a particular way.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the Williams plaintiffs focused on that precise point. We pointed out in our briefs that it was the prospective aspect of the judgment of Williams which made it declaratory in a sense, and that was the critical ruling in that case, or at least that was the relief that was sought first and foremost. And I would add in the aspect of the government's brief that the appellants have cited, that statement was made simply in a threshold argument that the government raised regarding Tucker Act jurisdiction. The government had noted, I believe, for the first time in the case, that there was at least a question as to whether the claims exceeded $10,000, and therefore there was a question as to whether the Little Tucker Act applied at all. That was the only point that was being raised there. It wasn't the issues that we're dealing with now. In response, the Williams plaintiffs, in their brief, argued quite forcefully that this was not simply a Little Tucker Act case, it was also a federal question case, and that the district courts had broader powers than the Court of Federal Claims to award declaratory and injunctive and prospective relief, and that's precisely what the district court in this case did. And so this notion that there might be a jurisdictional problem because of the $10,000 limit was simply misplaced. And by the same token, Mr. Landau's suggestion that if our position is accepted, that this was both a case involving declaratory relief, prospective declaratory relief, and monetary relief, that there would be some infirmity then with the Williams Court's jurisdiction is simply not correct.
So you're characterizing the monetary aspect of the original judgment as being incidental to the declaratory and injunctive relief?
Correct, Your Honor.
And is this based on the notion that back pay, albeit monetary, is equitable in nature, or simply that it was in the particular circumstances of this case less significant?
I would say neither, really, Your Honor.
Right.
We're not the equitable.
Why is it incidental then?
Well, if the court looks to the test that's formulated by the Fifth Circuit in Allison, incidental means that it flows directly from the award of declaratory injunctive relief. It is not consequential, it's concomitant with the award of declaratory relief.
In other words, the case was really about the future rather than the past.
That's one aspect of it, Your Honor. It might also be, and we've tied it into the Supreme Court's analysis in Walmart, it really is consistent with the court's analysis in Walmart of the notion of incidental relief versus relief that individualized relief versus relief that is awardable to the class as a whole.
What Supreme Court case tells us that if it's monetary relief, future, past, whatever, that affects the class as a whole, that you can bind someone who wasn't given notice, formal notice?
Well, there isn't a Supreme Court case on that. That was an issue that the Supreme Court in Walmart carved out. The closest the court got prior to that time was Tycor, which set up the issue.
So we're writing on a blank slate.
At least from the Supreme Court precedent. But as we've noted, the courts of appeals have adopted in varying degrees this notion of incidental damages, and it is consistent with, most importantly, it's consistent with the Supreme Court's reasoning in Walmart as to what the essential nature of a B2 class is. It doesn't matter what the labels are, and the parties have sort of gotten caught up in a lot of semantic descriptions of what money relief or damages can be, whether they're incidental or essential or predominant. I think the Supreme Court, the essence of its holding in Walmart, is that these labels don't mean anything. At least for B2, what is important is the notion that the claims for relief must be awardable to the classes as a whole.
Yeah, but what my problem is, suppose that the Williams case had never sought back pay at all, that it just had sought a declaration and injunction to pay the judges in the future without regard to the 95 to 99 statutes. Why wouldn't notice have been required in those circumstances? We'll put aside the opt-out question, but why wouldn't at least formal notice have been required?
If there was only injunctive or declaratory?
Yeah, well, to require the future payment of money.
Well, if there was no money claims at all, then notice certainly wouldn't be, it's generally not required under B2.
Well, what Supreme Court case tells us that in those circumstances notice wouldn't be required to find an absent class member?
Under B2, the court hasn't addressed a B2 class specifically, except again in the Tycor case, which it dismissed. So there, it's this case really presents a lot of open opportunities for the parties to litigate, at least at the Supreme Court level. One thing is clear, though, is that the notion that the appellants have suggested that notice and opt-out rights are the touchstone of due process in all cases and therefore must be available in all class contexts is not something the court has held. Going back as early as the seminal case of Hansberry versus Lee, the court addressed the issue as being one of adequate representation with parties of common interests. Over the years, as the Supreme Court's precedent has developed on the issue of notice in different contexts, yes, there has been a question as to whether it's simply a matter of adequate representation or does notice come into play somehow. The court addressed that most directly in Richards v. Jefferson County, Alabama, which it seemed to recognize that, yes, we have precedents that say notice is the touchstone of due process, but we also have Hansberry and other cases that seem to say it's adequate representation. We'll just assume that that issue is as Hansberry said, and we'll hold open the issue as to whether adequate representation can remedy an absence of notice in some cases. And so that's what we're saying here. The courts of appeals have sort of filled the void in that respect and looked to, in B2 cases, whether any types of money claims can be properly certified under that rule consistent with due process. And as we've explained, many cases have held, as long as they're incidental in the sense that they spring directly from the declaratory injunctive relief, they're okay. If it's individualized.
Are there court of appeals cases that have said that in the context where the injunctive relief in the future is for the payment of money?
Most of these cases, I believe, involve back pay claims.
Well, that's not the question. The question is, if the injunctive relief is itself concerned only with the payment of money, if they held that under those circumstances that we don't need to worry about notice and that any back pay claims are just incidental to the future relief?
I'm not quite specific on whether that question was addressed in those cases, Your Honor.
I mean, the classic case, in the civil rights area, is that someone is fired, they sue, they get an order, an injunctive order for reinstatement, and then in addition to the reinstatement, the court says, and by the way, you also get back pay for the period that you were out that you shouldn't have been fired. So the injunctive relief there would not be directly monetary, except to the extent that you say, well, but by reinstating the person, they are going to start being paid again. But that's not the gist of the monetary of the injunctive relief.
Mm-hmm.
So that in that setting, that's I think the setting in which that the back pay has been characterized as being incidental or ancillary for purposes both of jury trial and also to the extent that they are class action.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you. Go ahead. The point you were making.
Well, I was just going to say that in this case, the plaintiffs and Williams didn't specifically seek an injunction. They sought a declaration that the so-called Section 140 provision was unconstitutional to the extent it foreclosed pay increases provided by the 1989 Act. So that is the sort of the declaratory judgment that they received first and foremost. They argued in their appeal to this court that the critical point was that declaratory relief was prospective, and they also added that it was essentially equivalent to an injunction, even though they didn't specifically request an injunction. So it differs somewhat from the sort of classic Title VII discrimination.
What about the actual notice point? I mean, it strikes me in reading some of these Supreme Court cases on service of process that if A sues B and B has actual notice of the case, it's still insufficient to enter a judgment against B. You've got to have some sort of formal service. And why shouldn't that be true also in this context, that in order to have notice, if notice is required, that it's got to be formal notice rather than informal notice?
Well, I start off by saying, Your Honor, we don't know what the state of the actual notice
is. In my hypothetical, okay. I'm assuming that these judges actually knew about the pendency of this case. Mm-hmm. And they'd read the complaint, let's assume, okay? And they did nothing. And so why would that notice be sufficient constitutionally? Why wouldn't it have to be formal notice, some directive from the court, some mm-hmm. letter from the court advising them of the action and their rights to do something, either to opt out or to intervene or whatever it might be?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the answer is, I can only say, is generally due process is not a rigid formula set concept. It's the process that is due is dependent on the circumstances. And the Supreme Court has held, in the Espinoza case we cited in our brief, perhaps otherwise, that in some cases actual notice is sufficient to satisfy the strictures of due process, even though there is some sort of rule or process that requires a more formalized notice procedure.
Espinoza is the bankruptcy case?
Yes.
Yeah, but there was formal notice there. It wasn't informed. Right?
There was, I believe, two different types of notice. One was given under different rules of the bankruptcy process, yes.
Let me see if, following up on our exchange earlier, if I understand where you would say that actual notice is required in, let's say, a pure Tucker Act claim in which someone comes in and says, I and many people in my level should have been paid at a higher GS rate than we were. The conversion in the agency to a new GS scale, let's say, was unlawful, and it has cost all of us a varying amount of money, but basically something that could be easily calculated according to what one's GS level is. They go into either the Court of Federal Claims or into the District Court under the Little Tucker Act with a class action. Now, is it your view that due process would not require, assuming adequate representation, due process would not require notice to the absent class members in that setting?
Well,
it's a cohesive class in the sense that, you know, presumably everybody's in the same boat. Mm-hmm. But it's a pure Little Tucker Act action.
Well, Your Honor, of course, if they went into the Court of Federal Claims, it wouldn't be the issue of...
There is no B2 in the Court of Federal Claims.
Right, they're all opt-in. It's all opt-in.
Right, so they're in the District Court of the Little Tucker Act. Do you mm-hmm. say no problem, no notice? Mm-hmm.
Well, I would say that's really much like what occurred in Williams. And in that sense, so long as...
But you seem to be relying in Williams on the District Court's other sources of authority. Mm-hmm. I'm really trying to see whether your position is that even under the Little Tucker Act by itself, that still would not require due process. In other words, where the only thing the district court can do is to announce, not to issue a declaratory judgment under 2201 or not to issue an injunction, but simply announce as a predicate for the award of monetary relief that the action taken by the agency was illegal, and not to say, agency, you may not continue this action, although of course the agency, at least after the order became final, would not continue the action. So the difference between an injunction, a declaratory judgment, and a monetary award in that setting is kind of thin. But in any event, what is your position with respect to the due process issue in that setting?
Well, it might make a difference as to what the nature of res judicata is being asserted for claim preclusion, for future claims as they arise. And perhaps,
well, I was outside the claim, the claimants who brought it. I was never notified. The claimants who brought it lost, and I come in and say I would have made a different argument.
It's only back pay. The first purely, suit is only a back pay claim. Mm-hmm. There's no declaratory or injunctive relief. So
right.
You can't say that the back pay claim is incidental to some future relief.
Well, I would say then our argument doesn't rest entirely on the prospective nature. We made that point in response to the appellant's suggestion that there
right.
just simply would have been no difference at all if they had just dropped out their request for declaratory judgment or declaratory relief in this case, and we pointed out that, well, there would have been a difference in that they would not have received the prospective relief that they did in fact obtain.
Well, but as a practical matter, they would. I mean, you know, a declaratory judgment is not that different, I think you'd agree, from an order of the court granting retrospective relief predicated on an interpretation of statute or constitutional provision that is mm-hmm. not limited to the retrospective
right.
effect.
Well, you know, it's unusual because this the whole long-running dispute in these cases seem to be a back and forth between the courts and the Congress, issuing legal rulings, and then Congress responds, and then another legal ruling and Congress responds.
Well, let me make sure, though, I'm not sure I got your answer to my question. I may have interrupted you, or about to say, I think, that we haven't relied on the prospective relief. Is that a predicate to saying that, and therefore the due process would not require, even in the pure Tucker Act retrospective monetary relief setting, due process would not require notice to the person who does not have even actual notice and would have made a different argument, assuming adequate representation, albeit representation that person doesn't agree with?
Yeah. Well, I would say yes, due process doesn't require notice now, but with the caveat that you said that person would have argued that they could have made or would have made different arguments. Now, that's what we're sort of touching on. The parties really aren't in dispute as to the basic issue here. It's one of due process. Hansberry indicates that the issue for this court to decide is whether the procedures employed in the first suit fairly protected the interests of the absent class members. And we readily acknowledge that an absent class member can meet or can avoid the preclusive effects if they can come in and show some reason why their interests were not adequately protected. And that might be that they were not adequately represented, or that there were divergences of interest between themselves or and the named parties, or that there was any other issue, individualized issue, claim, defense, what have you, that differentiated their interests from those that were adjudicated. So in Your Honor's hypothetical, that if a plaintiff could come by and say, I would have made this argument, they missed the central argument that would have prevailed, carried the day. That's really, in a sense, saying that there wasn't adequate representation by class counsel, and that would provide a colorable basis to avoid the preclusive effect of the first judgment.
Does this case involve the same issues as Williams with respect to the 2007 denial of the COLA and the 2001 statute?
The core issue is the same, yes, as Mr. Landau seemed to acknowledge.
So there's no difference in terms of the constitutionality of the earlier statutes and the 2001 statute?
Well, the 2001 statute does present an additional argument, additional issue that the plaintiffs would need to overcome. However, to prevail, they still need to...
What's the difference between the 2001 statute and the earlier statute? I mean,
well,
I understand mechanically what the difference is, but in terms of the legal argument, is there a difference?
Well, this court in Williams held that the Section 1940 was not a permanent piece of legislation. It expired in 1981 at that time, and therefore didn't apply.
Can the 2001 statute be constitutional when the earlier statutes are unconstitutional?
Well, as the Solicitor General pointed out in the brief in opposition, for judges to taking the bench after 2001, the statute became effective, there couldn't understandably be a claim to future pay increases for that class of plaintiffs.
Yeah, but it is to that point. Mm-hmm. You would agree, I suppose, that if the 2001 statute is unconstitutional as to one class of judges, it's necessarily false, right? It can't be rewritten to apply it only to future judges.
If I understand Your Honor's question, you're saying can the 2001 statute apply retrospectively?
Well, you've argued in the cert op that the 2001, that there's no colorable claim by judges appointed after 2001 to
correct.
Challenge the 2001 statute. I'm saying, okay, let's assume that that's true. But if the 2001 statute is unconstitutional as to judges who were appointed before 2001, the statute falls, right? It can't be rewritten. So it only applies to some judges, correct?
That would be correct, yes. If it's unconstitutional,
yeah.
Okay.
Then it falls.
Yes.
Yeah. But the question I was asking was, put that aside, the 2001 statute is the only thing that denies the COLA with respect to 2007. Does that present any different issues than the 1999 statute, for example? I think your answer is it does not, right?
It doesn't. It adds an additional point. But even if it didn't exist, there would still be the same arguments that this court addressed in Williams as to the 2007. It's the same underlying claim. It just is for a different year.
If the 1999 statute is unconstitutional, so is the 2001 statute. Is that correct?
The 1999 statute?
Yeah, or the 1995 statute, say. If the 1995 statute is unconstitutional, so is the 2001 statute?
If the theory that the plaintiffs argued is correct, their theory was that the right to COLAs for the future vested in 1989, and therefore could not be altered or diminished after that time. So any statute that purported to block or deny future COLA increases necessarily would be violative of the compensation clause, yes. Of course, in Williams, this court held that Section 140 expired on its own terms in 1981, so it didn't apply at that time. Congress has, after the court's decision, made that amendment in 2001 to clarify that it applied in 1981 and all subsequent years. So if this case ever were to proceed further, that might become an issue, whether this court's ruling...
I'm a little confused. Let me see if I can be clear. If the 1995 statute is unconstitutional, does it necessarily follow that the 2001 statute is unconstitutional?
Well, I don't know if it follows from that point of logic that it's tied to the 95 statute's constitutionality. It's more...
in terms of the legal principle established in invalidating the 1995 statute, that same legal principle would invalidate the 2001 statute.
Well, it depends, because the 2001 statute deals with Section 140, which was enacted prior to the 1989 Act, which is the source of the right for future COLAs. So, if Congress is correct, as they seem to have indicated in 2001, that Section 240 took effect in 1981 and required congressional approval for pay increases in that year and every year thereafter, then there would be a defense to a constitutional challenge to future blocking statutes.
But that would be based on 140, right?
Correct.
Which would apply equally to the 1995 statute.
Correct. And in effect, it seems that in passing the blocking statutes, or actually in every year after 140 was enacted, Congress seemed to be acting under the authority of that provision in either authorizing a COLA or denying a COLA in those few specific years of 1995, 96, 97, and 99.
Thank you. Mr. Simpson, thank you. Mr. Landau, some rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have two quick points I'd like to make. First, the very decision that the government's trying to give preclusive effect to in this case is this court's decision in Williams. Well, this court wouldn't have rendered a decision in Williams if the government were correct in saying, as it's saying now, that Williams is a 1331 case. Because if that were so, then Williams would have gone to the regional circuit, not to this court. It had to be a Tucker Act case for this court to have jurisdiction. So the very decision to which they're trying to give preclusive effect would not exist as a matter of law if they were correct in their...
Is that true?
Our statute, 1295A2 in this case, says where the jurisdiction of the district court is based in whole or in part on 1346. So that would be true even if a 1331 claim were added.
Well, Your Honor, perhaps the more important point then is to say that this court, when it did exercise jurisdiction in Williams, limited itself to jurisdiction under the Tucker Act. I'd refer you to this court's opinion at 240 F3rd at 1025, where the court says, you know, the government raises a question about our jurisdiction under the Tucker Act, and so to avoid the whatever tricky jurisdictional issues are, we are limiting our jurisdiction in this case to the backward-looking claim for a single calendar year. And again, the government said in its brief into this court in Williams when it's discussing the jurisdictional issue, a case falls within the Tucker Act even if it seeks both monetary damages and equitable relief, as this one does, as long as the claim is essentially one for money damages, which is true here.
And do you happen to have, because I don't, have the actual order that was entered by Judge Penn in the Williams case?
I do, Your Honor. I have it right here. It's not on PACER because this was a PACER day. We can certainly submit that after.
Well, why don't you could give us the gist of it. What I'm going for, obviously, is it limited? Does it have a declaratory judgment in it?
Your Honor, it does not, and I think it's very telling. Here's the judgment for plaintiffs in Williams. It says, it is ordered in the judge and decree that gives the names of the named plaintiffs there, on their own behalf and have all those similarly situated, shall receive employment cost index adjustments, sometimes referred to as cost of living adjustments, pursuant to Ethics Reform Act of 1989 for the years 1995, 1996, and 1997, together with all other benefits which should have accrued to them based upon those adjustments. The defendant, United States of America, shall take appropriate action to calculate the amount due the plaintiffs and the members of their class pursuant to and consistent with the opinion and this order and that said plaintiffs have and shall recover costs from the said defendant. There's not one word about any declaratory or future-looking relief in that. It's all about past money judgment, damages.
If that order is not part of the record, readily accessible portion of the record before us, it would be helpful to us if the two of you could agree that, you know, that is the judgment and that's all there was that Judge Penn issued and provided us with a copy.
Absolutely.
We'd be happy to.
Right. Yes. I just to make sure there's nothing else floating around out there and so forth. But,
yeah,
but
just to be clear, so there was three things ordered the same day. There was an opinion granting summary judgment. These are all dated July 15th, 1999.
That we have.
The opinion, and then there's an order, and then there's a judgment. And so I was reading to you from the judgment, which is the operative legal document. The order just gives a number of orders, and the order does say that you get the past relief, which I mentioned. The order does say, order that you shall, the plaintiffs, that ECI adjustment shall be paid to plaintiffs and the members of their class in the future years. It says that. It's not, but there's no declaration in terms of that. But again, this court's jurisdiction, so there is a question as to what you do when you have a judgment, which is typically the operative legal document, and an order which seems to sweep more broadly than the judgment. But that being said, putting that aside, again, this court exercised jurisdiction in Williams on the basis of a backward-looking claim for a single year. So the very decision to which the government is trying to give issue preclusive effect here very carefully limited its jurisdiction and was not taking this as a case about the future. It was saying we're limiting our jurisdiction to this one backward-looking year.
Is there any difference in your view between the constitutional issues presented by the 1995 statute and the 2001 statute?
There are certainly different constitutional issues presented because there's a question of discrimination against judges in the 2001 statute. I think there are certainly potentially different issues at play in those two.
Could you win as to the 1995 statute and lose as to the 2001 statute?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think since all my clients were judges before 2001, I don't see how, and actually before 1995, I don't see how anything done in either of those statutes could take away whatever rights they had under the 1989 statute. Now, there may be some additional...
The 1995 statute is unconstitutional as to them, so necessarily is the 2001 statute.
Yes, yes, I think that that's true. The only other point I wanted to make, Your Honor, was to reaffirm the point suggested that you were making, that you're absolutely right, that the Supreme Court generally requires formal notice and doesn't, when there are procedures provided for notice, and that's why there's a case I think that you were alluding to that says you need formal service of process to start the time for responding to a complaint. And Justice Ginsburg wrote the opinion, the name escapes me now, but the question there was if you know that the person actually got the complaint, shouldn't that start the clock running? And the Supreme Court said no. There's an importance to the formal procedures. And if there's anything that's clear about the Williams case, it's that the formal procedures and the notice were not followed. This was certified again without opposition as a non-opt-out class, no notice class, and in a two-page order without any analysis. And now the government is saying, guess what? That bounds all the judges forever. And you know, I think again, one point not to lose sight of here is, you know, this is the legal issues here are structural constitutional issues. They're important to the individual judges, but they're also important to our system of government and judicial independence. And so this is a case at which one has to be very careful, it seems to me, when you say that the first person who can run in with a non-opt-out class can resolve a constitutional issue that will bind a generation of people. Imagine if Plessy versus Ferguson had been litigated as a non-opt-out, no-notice class. Presumably, under the government's view, that would preclude that issue from being decided for a generation.
Probably not. I mean, there are exceptions to issue preclusion.
But again, I think if ever, I mean, we made that point in our brief, Your Honor, but again, I think it's important to keep in mind that there's important constitutional issues here, and again, we don't think this is a close case with respect to the due process issues involved, because it's so clear here that the Williams case was all about money, and this court limited its jurisdiction in Williams to the money claim for a single year. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted. Thank both counsel.
All right.